Let's go to Proverbs 7. I was very disappointed this morning. It seems like on all of the portraits, someone is identified strongly. And like someone would come up and say, well, I can identify with the sluggard. And I say, yeah, I can too. And I was very disappointed there were no takers on the airhead this morning. Nobody seemed to be impressed with the airhead portrait. I know we've got some. We'd have to. Okay, we ended with looking at the, again, for you that were not here, just quick review. Remember, Proverbs chapter 7 goes in three parts. Prologue, which is in 7, 1 through 5, followed by the scenario of this young man, 7, 6 through 23, followed by a look back in the epilogue. Basically, the epilogue, occurring in 7, 24 through 27, is going to look back and it's going to say, after all that I've showed you about this young man and his fall, the epilogue assumes that there are some readers out there that are on the same path. And if they do not deal with the naivete, and if they do not deal with the fact that the young man lacks sense, and get some sense yourself, that we will join them. So there's an assumption that when we see this scenario, it can be repeated many, many times, and therefore we ought to be alert and to this thing. All right, we look then at the scenario beginning in verse 7 this morning, and we started with the victim. The victim is found in verses 6, 7, 8, and 9. Then we'll turn from the victim to the personality of the adulteress, and then we'll look from there at the tactics of. First of all, we're looking at the victim. It says, when I saw among the naive, and you should be able to recall from this morning the character sketch of what the naive is like, or the simple, or the open. I discerned among the youths a young man lacking sense. The expression lacking sense is what we want to look at tonight, and it will give us another portrait throughout the book of Proverbs. I'll also give you with the expression lacking sense, if you want it, the Hebrew expression for this group of people, because this group of people, apart from the original language, you'd never find. At least you wouldn't find all of them, because the word in the original gets translated various ways, and therefore it would not easily show up. And we put down that this is the cheser, put the ch with a dot, meaning for the purist, it's cheser, lev, L-A-V. And we pointed out that cheser is the idea of lacking, and lev is the Hebrew word for heart. So if we were real literal, this young man lacks heart. And then if we would study what the word heart entails, remember the heart entails the will, it involves the mind, and it involves the emotions. And therefore, throughout Proverbs, the author observes that there's a class of people that have some real deficient wills, that have some very deficient minds. That's the lacking sense. Pretty good expression. And that are sadly lacking in the control and the use of their emotions. And so the word heart is a little bit bigger than mind, a little bit bigger than sense, and takes in all of the inner being of the failure to have order in the will and order in the mind and order in the emotions. So we're going to be looking in the next few minutes at the Cheser Lev people throughout the book of Proverbs. And the first one will simply list what makes them have no sense. To commit adultery is to have no sense. To commit adultery is to have no sense. And we have that two places. We have it in 6:32, first of all, which says, the one who commits adultery with a woman is cheser lev. He lacks sense. Second is in 7:7, which we just looked at. I discerned among the naive, I discerned among the youths, a man lacking sense. And within context, he will lack sense because he will respond to the adulteress. So to commit adultery is to have no sense. Proverbs does not mince words. The Hebrew language doesn't miss words. If it says you, a man is stupid, it says you're stupid. And is very, very straightforward. One of the characteristics of all the Word of God. All right, second. A man who is led by force rather than personal discipline has no sense. One led by force rather than personal discipline has no sense. One led by force rather than personal discipline has no sense. And I'm just going to put a line there so I won't have to write no sense out half a dozen times tonight. One led by force rather than personal discipline has no sense. Chapter 10 and verse 13. Chapter 10 and verse 13. Now here is an example of how you lose it under the translation. You wouldn't recognize that this is the same person because the English translation is different. The character that we're talking about is found in the last two words of verse 13, lacks understanding. And that is Chesser Lev. It's the same thing, only it's gotten translated differently. So notice the idea. It says, on the lips of the discerning wisdom is found. But the rod, see that's forceful type thing. The rod is for the back of him who has no sense. And notice the emphasis, rather than be led by his own personal discipline, he's got to be led by a rod on the back. And therefore, the use of the rod in order to get him to go in the right direction is necessary. And what does he say about the person that acts that way? That always takes the rod for direction is a person who lacks sense. All right? Second, the one who makes an enemy rather than keep his mouth shut doesn't have any sense. I have an idea we're not going to get any takers on the man without sense tonight either. Okay? One who makes an enemy, rather than contain his thoughts or contain his mouth, lacks sense. One who makes an enemy, rather than restraining himself from saying what he thinks, lacks sense. And let's notice that in chapter 11 and verse 12. 11:12, which reads, he who despises his neighbor lacks sense. And despising your neighbor instead of doing what? Well, the next line says, by way of contrast, the man of understanding does what? Keeps silent. And so the emphasis is the man that despises his neighbor, and obviously he's doing it with his mouth. He has an opinion. He makes an enemy. Rather than keeping his mouth shut, lacks sense. On the other hand, the opposite of that is a man of understanding who does what? Who keeps silent. He may dislike his neighbor, but he knows enough to keep his mouth shut and not create an enemy. All right, next. Chesser Lev people. The man or the one who pursues speculative ventures lacks sense. One who pursues speculative ventures rather than solid opportunity lacks sense. One who pursues speculative ventures rather than solid opportunity lacks sense. This is the person who's always got a way to make a quick buck. And he's always speculating. He's forever got something going. You've met people like that. Every time you meet them, you wonder, what has he got going now? And according to the book of Proverbs, this man is foolish. Chapter 12 and verse 11. And the idea will be this man has opportunity for solid achievement, but he blows it on speculation. Chapter 12, verse 11. He who tills his land will have plenty of bread. And there's your given opportunity. You've got that. But he who pursues vain things lacks sense. And notice the idea, instead of taking the solid opportunity of tilling his land, the given opportunity, he fritters away on what? All this other silly, speculative type thing. By the way, very interesting thing in that that 11th verse, see the latter part that says, he who pursues, that is an intensive word in Hebrew. And what would that say to us? It says the man is not lazy. He just doesn't have any sense in what he's going after. It says the man doesn't lack energy. He's got lots of energy, but he lacks discrimination. So let's put under there, he has energy. Comes off of that strong, intense word. He has energy, but he has no discrimination. And isn't that typical that a person that is always after some speculation of some sort usually has lots of energy and enthusiasm? I mean, they're working all of the time to find something new to pursue. And Proverbs says, why don't you just have some good sense and take the field you've got and plow it and you'll have bread. And so take advantage of solid opportunities. Okay? F, one who guarantees a guarantee doesn't have any sense. One who guarantees a guarantee has no sense. Going surety, co-signing would be the idea. And guaranteeing a guarantee simply means that one person has agreed to purchase something and make payments on it, and you are willing to back them up legally and in a binding way and say, if you don't make it, I'll stand good for you. And it says a person who does this, by the way, this occurs a number of times in Proverbs, is a person who has no sense. Okay, chapter 17, verse 18. Which reads, a man lacking in sense pledges and becomes surety in the presence of his neighbor. Actually, the word pledges in Hebrew is guaranteeing a guarantee. So the man lacking in sense guarantees a guarantee. He cosigns. Notice Proverbs is intensely practical, is it not? Okay, next. Two more things about this man. Next, the man who is a sluggard has no sense. The man who is a sluggard has no sense. Chapter 24 and verse 30. 24:30. It's kind of interesting here in the 30th verse, being a sluggard and having no sense is synonymous. If you're one, you're the other. Now that involves us all because a lot of people identified with the sluggard thing and now you're caught. You don't have any sense either. Okay, 24:30. God shouldn't talk to us this way, should he? He should sing lullabies to us. I'm doing that. Don't want to hear these things. Okay, I passed by, verse 30, the field of the sluggard and by the vineyard, by the parallel line, by the vineyard of a man, chesed-lev, lacking sense. And so notice the sluggard, one who does not spend his time well, one who is lazy, lacks sense. And he points there to verse 31, behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with nettles and its stone wall were broken down. And as you well know, this man's field with the weeds growing up in it is indication of the fact that he is a sluggard. And I'm sure, since I didn't plant one this year, I could suggest that we might visit one another's houses and look at our gardens. And we can put up the list of all of the sluggards. Or we'd get real personal and visit garages. Sluggard lives here. Okay. Next. And we touched on this morning. Folly is fun. Folly is fun. I'll put that in quotes. Is the person who lacks sense. And we found that in chapter 15 and verse 21. Folly simply means we're pursuing things that don't make any difference. Folly is, for example, sitting in front of the TV set all evening. 3 hours of what good is it? Folly is fun or folly is a joy to him who lacks sense. And so notice you have a nice little sketch there of what? We had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 areas of giving a portrait of this particular man. I plan as soon as, well, I shouldn't say this because I plan to, I want to do a little booklet and just call it Portraits of Character in Proverbs and do a chapter, you know, the portrait of the sluggard, a portrait of the man with no sense, a portrait of an airhead, and so forth. And I shouldn't have said that because now you'll be looking for it and you'll be using that sluggard thing on me right and left, won't you? Okay, now there comes into it an encouraging thing. First of all, we had the readout of what the man is like. And now let's add another point to it. And the fact that there is a hope for those who lack sense. There is hope for this group. And the fact we know there is hope is found from 9:4 and 9:16. We had them this morning in connection with other things. Let's take a look at them. There is hope. We don't have to lack sense. We may qualify for it, but we don't have to stay that way. Chapter 9, verse 4. That's one of the most encouraging things about Proverbs. It is so strong about what we are. It's also so strong about you don't have to stay this way. You can change, and here's the book that can change it for you. Chapter 9, verse 4. Notice here he's put in with the naive. Whoever is naive, let him turn in here. To him who lacks understanding, she says, come eat of my food. And this is wisdom speaking. So we don't have to stay there, see? And in verse 16, whoever is naive, let him turn in here. And to him who lacks understanding, she says, and so forth. So we don't have to stay that way. There is hope for those that lack sense. Provided we choose to pursue wisdom. And let's emphasize, provided we choose to pursue wisdom, which of course is in God's Word. That's up to us. We don't have to do it. The passage begs us to it. It asks us to do it. It says, please do it. But it still leaves it on our doorstep to make the choice to pursue it. Okay, what is the consequence of a person who lacks sense? Let's suppose a person remains that way. And the consequences of that are found in 15:21. Oh, that's wrong. What am I doing today? It's not 15:20. Does anyone happen to know? It's the second time I've done that today. I've put the point out and then put a passage by it. I'll find it for you. Make it next week. The emphasis there is it talks about words coming out from the wise man that help people. But a man that has no sense is not able to do anything for himself. And so the emphasis of the consequences will be he helps no one, is able to help no one, not even himself. He helps no one, not even himself. And I will get the reference for that next Sunday. Okay, now let's go back to Proverbs 7, and we've had a description of this young man. And we've studied a person this morning who is open and simple, and we studied this morning, this evening, a man who lacks sense. And as we sit in the front room and look out the window, he says, I saw among the open and the naive and the simple, I discerned among the youths a young man lacking sense. Now, for a person that has that characteristic, it is only a matter of time before the fall occurs. And we will find out in this context that he is going to meet a temptation. Have you heard the expression, have you not? He is an accident looking for a place to happen. Well, if we are among the naive and among the ones lacking sense, it may not have happened yet. But we are simply an accident waiting to happen. Or we could put it in terms of this context. The young man described in verse 7 is nothing more than a spiritual tragedy waiting to happen. And it hasn't occurred yet, but he's ready for it, he's waiting for it, and it's only a matter of time. And therefore, notice what we've got. In verse 7, we've got the personality described. Verse 8, the place. And in verse 9, the time. The emphasis is along the line that here's this young man drifting along. He really doesn't have any sense. He is really open and naive. And years have passed and it hasn't happened. But this night, it all came together. And you might say that all of these things gang up, and suddenly, as he's vulnerable, he gets at the right place at the right time, and it all happens. And so the emphasis for application could very well be, if we are among the open and those who are not open to the Word, and among those who are in the category of lacking sense, you may say, well, I'm 30, been doing great, nothing has happened yet. But wait, the time, the circumstances, the place, everything someday will come together and the tumble takes place. And notice for this young man, it all comes together now. And coming down to verse 8, we now come to the right place for his fall. And that is described in verse 8. Verse 8 says, and again, it's described the personality, see? And that kind of personality is going to fall into temptation, and we are now getting the scene set for his fall. With him, in the strict context, it's right place, right time, and the right girl. And by right, I don't mean right in the sense of proper. I mean it just all worked together for the fall, right to produce a fall. So verse 8, passing through the street near her corner, and he takes the way to her house. Now, question in verse 8, did this young man get in the right place for a fall intentionally or unintentionally? Was he out looking or did he stumble into this? And I think we can say both. That in the first place, in the first part of the verse, I would take it would to be unintentional. I would take the second part to be intentional. Because the first part of verse 8, here he is, he's simply passing through the street near her corner, and there's no way you can prove that he knew that. That could have been coincidental. So I would take this as he's walking through the streets, and he is near her corner, and more the idea that he's telling us that for the reader. He didn't realize this type of thing. However, notice in the second half of verse 8, you have more volitional activity on his part, and he takes the way to her house. So I would take this part to be intentional. Now, I won't be emphatic on that. You could take it to be all planned out. You could take it to be none planned out. He's just walking in the wrong area and he turns down this way and he goes up to her house. But I think that's a little bit difficult to explain all the way through the context. So both of these things are involved. Obviously, he doesn't have what? He doesn't have sense. We've been told that. And he doesn't have sense to do what? He doesn't have the sense to keep out of the place of temptation. We know he lacks sense. We've been told that. So he lacks sense to keep from the place of temptation. He hasn't done anything yet. He has not sinned, but he didn't have any sense. And again, you don't have to. You can lack sense without sinning. You know, we had back there about going surety. You know, you can't say if you guarantee a guarantee, you have sinned. It just says you've guaranteed a guarantee, and you don't have any. You're not using your head. You don't have any sense. And so, I take it right here. He simply has not the sense to keep himself out of the place of temptation. And with that, we now come to the right time. Right place for a fall and the right time for a fall, and that is in verse 9. Notice in reading through verse 9 the progression from twilight on into the night. You go from twilight to the evening to the midnight. And I think that's there for a reason. Reading verse 9. In the twilight, see the sun is going down now. In the evening, we've moved up now. In the middle of the night and in the deep darkness. So notice he is out for a long, long, long time in the streets. The right time is there. So when you see the idea of progression from twilight to evening to midnight to the very dark part of the day, the young man was not only lacking sense, but the young man was idle. He didn't have anything to do except get in trouble. A second thing that's involved. I think Greg and David have been, I've always enjoyed hearing it because they can quote this backwards and forwards. I've heard Betty ask Greg and David when they wanted to stay out late the following question: what is there to do after midnight except get in trouble? And they, I think, hate that question, but they have been asked it many, many times. And for this young man, what was there out there past midnight except trouble? And consequently, you have an idle young man who was out in the streets of perhaps Jerusalem, a city of some sort, and there was nothing to do, and having nothing to do, he got in trouble. It also points to a second thing, more strongly in their culture than it would in ours, is that he has apparently abandoned the home. Not in the sense of leaving home, but he's abandoned home fellowship. Maybe he didn't have a good home, I don't know. But as you well know from earlier Bible studies, we pointed out that in the evening, the Greeks had a word for that long, long meal, the deitnon. And it was protracted. It was a 3- and 4-hour meal. Several reasons for it is you didn't just go out in Jerusalem and walk down the streets and have lighting. You stop to think, if we didn't have lighting on streets and lighting in building and only had candles, how it would curtail nighttime activity? Be no more night baseball. You couldn't drive your chariot very well because you'd hit someone else's chariot or run over their cat or something of that sort. And consequently, things would be quite different. And basically, with twilight, you go home to your own home, you have a meal, you have fellowship with the family. But where's this boy? Something is said in terms of he's abandoned the traditional home fellowship and he's out looking for something else. All right, now, with all of that set up, he has no sense, he's young, he's open, he's out in the night instead of where he ought to be, and sure enough, in that context, he meets temptation. So we'll now look at the adulteress. And she comes in verses 10 through 21, and we'll divide that two ways. First of all, her personality, and second, her tactics. Her personality, 10 through 12. Now let's just read through those verses and you'll see how the personality is described. It says, "Behold, a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot, cunning of heart. She's boisterous and rebellious. Her feet do not remain at home. She is now in the streets, now in the square. She lurks on every corner. So," verse 13, "her tactics, she seizes him," and so forth down through here. So first of all, we've got something about her personality. Number one, she is the aggressor. She is the aggressor. He was not. And therefore, I say that for two reasons. In verse 11, or verse 10 rather, it says simply says, "Behold, a woman comes to meet him." In the context, I would assume that his intentions are probably wrong, not wrong. And I got two reasons for saying that. His intentions were not wrong. He was not out looking for her. His intentions were not wrong. And I would support that from two angles. The first one being is she seeks him, he doesn't seek her. So the first reason is she is the seeker, he is not. She seeks, not he. And second, he resists. Had he been out in pursuit of her, he wouldn't have resisted. This would have been what he was pursuing. And we know he resisted because you have her speech coming down, and notice in verse 22, suddenly he follows her. And so that points out the fact that there had been resistance on his part, and therefore I would take it that his intentions were apparently not wrong. Now that carries with it a tremendously important lesson, and the tremendously important lesson is simply this. His lack of wrong intentions did not spare him from the person whose intentions were wrong. Think about that. His lack of wrong intention. I'm sure you could have said, "Young man, are you out here looking for a prostitute?" He said, "No way, no way is that what I'm after." But he lacked sense. He was in the wrong place, the wrong time. He was not where he should have been. And therefore, even though his intentions may have been right, he became the victim of somebody whose intentions were wrong. And that is a very, very, very important lesson. And you may say, well, I'm doing this in all innocence. I have no wrong intentions. Have you ever been had someone whose intentions were wrong take advantage of your lack of wrong intention and suddenly found yourself in a very, very difficult situation? All right? She is the aggressor. Second, she dressed the role. She dressed the role. And that's found in the words, latter part of, well, verse 10. Behold, a woman comes to meet him. She is the aggressor. And second, she's dressed as a harlot. And again, as we said, as you probably well know, prostitutes do not have uniforms that are got a big P on the back or something like that. What would be the idea? Did he simply say, oh, there goes a girl, she's got a prostitute's uniform on? Those girls don't have standard clothing in terms of the type of thing, but what is standard about the clothing? The standard thing about the clothing is it is suggestive. Now, I'm not by any means suggesting that the women wear bags. There was a time when there were bag dresses, weren't there? Wasn't there? Wasn't that a style once? Let's hope that never happens again. Sack dresses, yeah. Okay, I think just a guy, and this is judgment matter. For any woman buying clothes, look at the clothes, and they can do one thing. You can say the object of the clothing is to cover, or the object of the clothing is to exhibit. And for a believer, a woman who is a believer ought to look at that. And she ought to say, I want to look good. But I've got to look at this in the light of the fact, is it basically to exhibit or is it basically to cover? And to cover doesn't mean it has to be homely or ugly by any means. But there is an extreme when the emphasis is obviously, well, by this dress, the eye is going to be drawn to one place or and this sort of thing. And therefore, she comes, in this context, she's dressed the part. Okay, she's the aggressor, she dressed the role. Number three, some things about her personality or her character. We got her clothes. We got her... She comes off in this context as so aggressive. Okay, her character, number one, she is cunning. That word cunning points to her whole demeanor. It doesn't mean just words. It means everything about her is cunning in the sense of skillful to get his attention. She is more than his match, as we'll see. More than whose match? A young man who never bothered to get any sense. And a young man who never bothered to be anything except open and simple. And apparently innocent to this point, her cunning is too much for him and he falls. She is more than his match. Second, our text says she's boisterous. And I wish our translation had simply stuck with the simple meaning of the Hebrew word. It means to move noisily. Noisy. Horsey, I guess, is our expression. Noisy. Now, she is noisy, and we ought to set this in contrast to something. Go over to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter 3. This ought to all say that for those who have daughters, teach her not to be these things. No. Teach her not to be cunning and divisive and the kind of person that manipulates. Do children, if they're allowed, will they manipulate? Are those little minds pretty sharp at manipulating? And if again, if you have a daughter, especially in the light of this context, don't let her be manipulative. Stop that, because it's one of the characteristics that this woman bears. After all, every adulteress was somebody's little girl once. Okay, 1 Peter chapter 3, notice the contrast in verse 4. It's talking about the woman and her demeanor and decorum and appearance. And says, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. And notice the woman in Proverbs is the very antithesis of this type of thing. See, boisterous. And then third, it says she's rebellious. And the word rebellious simply is used in the Old Testament for anyone or anything that refuses restraint. Just will not have restraint. Just cannot stand to be restrained. Let me show you to an interesting context. It's used, for example, of a heifer in Hosea 4:6. A heifer that hates to have the yoke put on, just cannot stand it. And it's the same word that Proverbs uses to describe this woman. In Hosea chapter 4 and verse 6, it says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." Have I done it again? I have done it again. Does anyone say, huh? Is that it? No, I want the... it's where he tells Israel that you're like a heifer. Well, at any rate, there's a verse in the Bible, and it's in Hosea, that talks about Israel being... Bob? What? 4:16. I promise, I have worked and studied this week. 4:16. Yeah, since Israel is stubborn... And that's our same word for rebellious. Like a stubborn heifer. And what's the idea? You will not accept my restraints. So in this context, refuses divine restraint, especially divine restraint. And the particular area is in her sexual morality, which she's rejected it. Then fourth, going back to Proverbs 7. I hope it's 7. 7:11b. Her feet do not remain at home. So notice the character is home is not her priority. She's a gadabout. That's her character. Okay, now we can move to her tactics. There's her character, now her tactics. Verse 13, beginning in verse 13, on through 21. And we'll put these just in a 1-2-3 way. What is her first approach? How does she get to him? Step one, physical contact. Verse 13. So she seizes him, and notice the very initial approach is physical contact. She seizes him and kisses him, and with a brazen, the idea of involved in the word brazen is impudent, defiant of moral standards, and with a brazen face or a defiant face, she says to him, so notice we start with physical contact. Second, she uses a very good cloak of propriety. And we teach that by simply saying that she doesn't grab him and kiss him and say, "Let's commit adultery." That's not her approach at all. She starts off almost pious. Notice verse 14, "I was due to offer peace offerings. Today I have paid my vows." Now, first of all, you can see the religious flavor to it, can you not? Because the peace offering was part of the Old Testament requirement. And we've been to it previously. Let me, for you that were not here, however, let me simply give you the passage. You can look at it later. Leviticus chapter 7, verse 14 says that on the very day that you make a peace offering, you've got to eat it. So she has, on this day, and that's the force of the words today here. Verse 14, "I was due to offer peace offerings. Today, I have paid my vows." And by Leviticus 7:14, I hope, by Leviticus 7:14, you had to eat it that day. And therefore, she's simply saying, "Hey, my cupboard is full. I'm going to have a big meal tonight, and I don't have anyone to eat it with." And notice that that is her initial invitation. She knows what she has in mind, and yet she is going to cover it with propriety. Third, she's smart. She goes to the male ego. And notice how she appeals to it down in chapter 7 and verse 15. And the best way to appeal to a male ego is to make him feel like he is the most important person in the world. I mean, I didn't have anybody until I found you. And men love that. don't you? Verse 15. Therefore, and notice how she really makes him feel important. You're the one I've been looking for. Therefore, I've come out to meet you to seek your presence earnestly, and I've found you. I have looked and looked and looked, and the implication is nobody else can satisfy like you. You are the one I'm looking for, and that appeals to the male ego. He doesn't fall yet. He's going to. Why? He doesn't have any sense. And he's going to because he's open. And we've already seen that sketch, and that's why the author of Proverbs wants us to see this, is that he's simply a spiritual disaster waiting to happen. Okay, then notice number 4. She appeals to male sensuality. And that is in verse 16 and 17. I have spread my couch with coverings, with colored linens of Egypt. I have worked, sprinkled my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. And that's simply an appeal to his sensuality. It's an appeal to his imagination. Think about it. She is shrewd in the fullest sense of the word. Then following that, she hides the real issue. What is the real issue is adultery. How do you hide that word? What's the best word in the world to hide the word adultery? Love, right? Call it love. And that's what she does. Notice coming down to the verse. Verse 18. Come, let us drink. And notice how this is all covered over. She does not say, come, let us drink our fill of adultery till morning. No, she says, come, let us drink our fill of love until the morning. What a shabby view of it. It hides the real issue. And then 6, she has contempt for her own husband. And that's in verse 19. Two things, really, in verses 19 and 20. One, in these two verses, is contempt for her husband, but there's more than that. There's a recognition that, hey, this can be done safely. You know, nobody will know. And naturally, the young man might be wary, well, what if your husband comes home in the middle of the night? And so she wants to lay his mind at ease and saying that everything is set up nicely. And it says in verse 19, notice the contempt for the man, not my husband, for the man is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He has taken a bag of money with him. At full moon, he will come home. And that was obviously an assurance that he's going to be gone for some time because he's taken money. See how everything came together on this night? He had no sense. He got in the wrong place. It happened at the wrong time. And it just happens that this woman's husband was gone. See, it was all set up for a fool to fall into, which he did. Okay, 21, 22, you've got the kill. The thought of 21 and 22 and 23 is very much the concept of death. Verse 21, with her many persuasions, she entices him. With her flattering lips, she seduces him. And here we go. The man lacking sense falls suddenly. He follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter. Or as one in fetters to the discipline of the fool until an arrow pierces through his liver, an expression of perhaps the way the animal was killed. A bird hastens to the snare, so he does not know that it will cost him his life. When it talks about costing him his life, we ought to say something that is important. I think we'll probably, in the course of doing Proverbs, say something about life and death in Proverbs. In Proverbs, life does not consist in just the quantity aspect, you know, existing. In Proverbs, life is a thing that's got quality to it, very definite qualitative type thing. So that in Proverbs, you can have a living death. And I take it this is the emphasis. You're not going to die physically, but it's going to cost him his life. It's going to cost him his quality life. There's going to be a quality that this is going to take out of his life that is going to be very, very, very expensive. Now, with that, notice the author of Proverbs is going to be very, very realistic in the context. And he is going to assume something about the people that are reading Proverbs 7. And what's he going to assume? He's going to assume that there are a lot of people out there that don't have any sense. And they're not making any effort to get it. that they're very open, and he assumes in verses 24 through 27 that the scenario he's just described is going to occur many, 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 many times. And he's right. So the epilogue rests on the assumption that many of the readers may stumble in the same way. So we have verse 24. Now therefore, my sons, listen to me. Pay attention to the words of my mouth, and then notice he is going to give the line of defense, or we should say lines of defense. How can those that have not become involved protect themselves? What would you say would be the first thing that a young man ought to do to get to the root of it? I won't ask because you wouldn't want to reveal it, you know. Obviously, the first line of defense is your thought pattern, right? First line is mental. And notice we've got that in verse 25. Do not let your heart turn to not your feet. That's not first. That's true. That's going to follow. But the mental is first. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. And if you go back to chapter 6, verse 25, which you have the same context, 6:25, how do you protect yourself? Do not desire her beauty in your heart. So notice the first line is mental. Do not, and what would our word be that is a very good word for it? Do not fantasize. Do not fantasize over the adulteress. That's where adultery starts, in a man's mind, is fantasy. All right, second is just plain physical. It says, do not stray into her paths. And by physical, I mean keep out of, keep physical distance. Just don't get near. Don't wander in that area. Don't go where you could be involved. What happened to the young man here that was naive? He took a stroll, and he took a stroll away from home and in the wrong direction, and he found trouble. Third, can you think of what the third might be? Can you see it there? For many are the victims she has cast down. Think of the what? Afterwards. Numerous are all her slain. Think about that. We could think of, as we did last week, what did she do to David? From his sin with Bathsheba on to the end of the book, everything went down. Numerous are all her slain. Her house is the way to death, descending to the chambers of death. So, third, consider the afterwards. Consider the afterwards. Okay, that completes that chapter. Let me say one thing, however, in closing. If you're here and you have become involved in that sort of thing, if it's going on, stop it. If you have been involved and it has been confessed to the Lord and taken care of, forget it. And I hope by going through this, I have not aroused a guilty conscience on a part of a person who has handled a thing and it's been taken care of. Just don't lack sense and do it again. And therefore, confession takes care of it for the believer. No question about that. And I don't mean to create guilt. But we should take the very, very stern warning given to us in Proverbs. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word that is true. We're thankful that it makes it possible to consider the afterwards, be sketching out what it is before it ever happens. And we're thankful that we don't have to experiment with life and be burned and not recognize what happened to us. We're thankful we can be forewarned, we can have wisdom, and we pray tonight that as we continue to see characters in the book of Proverbs, that we'll honestly identify ourselves. None of us sitting here tonight can help but realize that in many, many cases, how often we have lacked any sense at all. We've lacked sense because we have tried to operate on our own wisdom. We have lacked sense because we have neglected your word. And we can recount the many, many, many times that we've paid the consequences of doing it. So we pray that as we continue in this book, we'll learn sober lessons from it in Christ's name. Amen. We will break about 5 minutes, and then we'll have the Moody Science film.